I'm Terry Ashley. I'm 57 years old. Today's date is October 30th, 2015. We are in Joan's home, and she is a friend and colleague of mine.
I'm Joan Hyman, and I'm 63 years old, and today is October 30th, 2015. Fort Collins, Colorado is where we are in my apartment. And Terry is a friend and colleague.
Hi, Joan.
Hi. Are you going to get us started?
I'm going to get us started.
Okay.
We talked a little bit about having a conversation about Philip. Mm-hmm. And I thought it would be fun to start with you telling us how you met him.
Okay. I'm trying to think of how to do that relatively briefly. I was traveling. It was the summer of 1977. No, I'm sorry. The summer of 1978. And I had just lost a dog who I had a very, very perhaps too close attachment to. And I had been working back east, and I just wanted everything to change. I had been living alone with this dog for a few years, and I thought I was very independent, and then the dog was gone, and I was lost. And so all of a sudden, the perfect job didn't seem perfect anymore, and the perfect life didn't seem perfect. And so I got involved in a training program for human relations and group facilitation training that was spaced throughout the country and throughout the year. It was 500 hours spaced throughout that year. And so the first training session was in Denver in July, I think, June or July. And that was a two-week session. And I met, while I was there, I met a man who had gone through that same training program and who lived in Denver. And we got to be friendly. And he invited me to house sit for him when he was leaving, and I needed to stay or wanted to stay in Denver for a couple of weeks, actually for 2 months, before the next installment of the training program, which was out in Vancouver. So that was great. And he introduced me to a friend of his who happened to be Philip's ex-wife. And he said, I think you'll really like each other. And we did. And she then went back to Greeley, and where she was living, and met with Philip, who, now that they were exes, were friendly and sharing their son, their four-year-old son. So she went back to him and said, I've met somebody who you really like. And a few weeks later, 2 weeks later maybe, I had the opportunity to meet Philip. And he was coming out of a meditation, a group meditation at somebody's house, and I was a little, my friend invited me to go to that meditation, but I was a little leery of it, and it all seemed very guru-ish, and I wasn't there yet. And so they would do this very dynamic meditation and then sit in a hot tub in the backyard. So when they came out of that, they were pretty naturally high. And my friend, brought me back to that house. He skipped the hot tub, went and got me, and brought me back to the house to meet them. And Philip walked out the door, and he looked at me. He walked over to me, put his arms around me, and he said, "Oh, it's you." And I thought, this is either the nuttiest person I've ever met, I've ever met, or this is it. And we hung out together a couple of times, and then I left. and went to the West Coast and did my hours on the West Coast. And for the very first time in my life of always seeking solitude, I got lonely. And I was in San Diego, and I was staying at I was staying with a friend from college, and you know, all I had done was send postcards every once in a while to Philip, and I once or twice wrote a letter, so he knew where I was, and he called, and we talked for a while, and he had a wonderful telephone voice and person. I mean, he was just, his voice was very, I mean, I really didn't know him that well. And I told him, you know, this feeling that I'd never really had before of actually feeling a little bit displaced and lonely. And he said, well, why don't you come home? And I was just like, oh, gosh, you know. So I did. I, you know, it took a couple of months, but I went, I thought, well, I had to go from San Diego. The next installment of the program was in Indianapolis in March, and this was January. And so I thought, well, that tells me where I'm going. I'm going to Colorado, and I'll hang out there for a while and visit this guy and see. And I never left.
So, what did Philip look like back in 1978?
It's funny because I forget this until I look at photos, but he had quite long hair, you know, like here.
And, shoulder length.
Yeah. Shoulder length, and very beautiful sort of auburn red that, you know, in later years, I mean, it turned almost blondish white. Mustache that I never saw him without. He never shaved that mustache. He was very, very, I used to describe him as having a yoga body. I mean, he was very lithe and vital and healthy looking, very flexible and playful, and both in his, the way he moved in his body and in his thinking about things.
So Philip was a pretty non-traditional guy.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, well, he, here's a good example of that. He actually dropped out of college in his last quarter of his senior year because everybody always said, why would you do such a thing? And he said, because it no longer held any meaning for me. And I just didn't see the point. And I looked at my professors, and they were all alcoholics and depressive and unhappy. And I just didn't want to participate in it any longer. He also managed to, as a freshman, when he first started here at CSU in Fort Collins, he very quickly sort of flunked himself out. He spent all of his time sitting in the Oval. And I think there was a kind of rebellion, not kind of, there was a very big rebelliousness about him. He had struggled for as long as he could remember with his father. He was a very introverted and sensitive young boy whose father wanted him to play football and be on the wrestling team and be interested in cars, and Philip wasn't that at all. And so he struggled from, it seems like in his stories, it was from day one. You know, he walked like a girl, or his hair was too long, or it was too curly, or his father was just not getting the son that he wanted. And Philip was his first son. He was also, he was at, by intelligence testing, he was like above genius level. And I think that can either be a blessing, but is often also a curse, in the sense that he had no patience for, or almost no tolerance for, people whose minds couldn't move in the way that his did. And he, I mean, it took me a while when we were together, when we first got together, even to kind of learn how to think with him, because it was not an A to B to C kind of thinking. It was a leaping kind of thinking, and he'd get very impatient if I wasn't able to leap with him. You know, by the time we'd been together for a long time, he would get very impatient if I almost couldn't read his mind, because he just expected that of me. He didn't expect it of other people. He just kind of turned from a lot of other people. He ended up being very solitary. Even though, when I first met him, he was involved in this completely beautiful alternative community in Greeley, of people from all over the place that maybe gathered there because UNC had a program that was more of a design your own in their education department. I don't know why, but there was a community of probably 30 to 50 people who were, you know, 1970s-ing, and people who had grown into themselves in the late 60s. I mean, Philip was 5 years older than I, and so the late 60s was what he considered his time. And he was a musician. He sang. He had a beautiful singing voice. He sang in choirs when he was in high school. And he sang in a rock band. He played the guitar, but it was really the singing, I think, that mattered to him. And he went from this sort of loved by everyone, enjoyed by everyone, somebody who was extremely quick and funny and fun-loving, to somebody who just suddenly said, I don't want any of that. And we moved away from it way back in 1980, I think. I'm sorry, but I have...
Mm-hmm. What was Philip passionate about?
Well, I think he was most passionate about being true to himself, and finding and expressing his creative voice through poetry, and through being as close as he could to himself, to being himself, with people. And if he couldn't be that with people, then he preferred not to be with anyone. He loved music most of the time, I think, that he was alive. There was music on in the house, classical music, and then folk music, and what we call New Age music now. He lived to read. I mean, literature, fiction, created worlds for him that he would climb into. And, you know, if he was reading something and somebody was in trouble, Philip was in trouble. I mean, he was so identified with what he was reading that sometimes I would wish that he would stop reading a particular book because it just pervaded the entire house for as long as that book was being read. And it was the same thing with film. You know, in our early years, we were very taken with foreign films and often couldn't get through a week without going to a film. In later years, he decided that that was an illusion and manipulating of emotions, and so we stopped going to any films. You know, I've been to the movies. I went to the movies for the first time in the month after he died, because I was staying with my mother and she wanted to go to a movie. Same thing with television. That went out in the early 1980s. So I think the passion was always about somehow or other seeking his truth.
Yeah. Well, how long were you married, Joan?
I forget, because we lived together for 3 years before we got married, so I think of it as 37 years.
So when did you and when did Philip, maybe not the same, realize that he was seriously ill?
That's a good question, because I'm not sure that either one of us ever fully realized it until he was dying. I mean, literally, like the day before he was dying. Because even when we got him finally to the hospital in San Diego, we were still somehow deluded into thinking that he was just weak and needed to be built up and was going to be okay. And even when they told me, even when I had to make the decision, because he was no longer, he was under the influence of a drug that he wasn't seeming to come out of, when we decided not to do a surgery that would have meant that he would never breathe without a oxygen something, and that he would never eat again except through a feeding tube, which we didn't know, which the surgeon didn't tell us. But then another doctor explained it to me. So even then, when I had to make that decision that that would not be the way he would want to live, and even when they said, well, then we'll treat him like a hospice patient, I think that's when I knew, but I still was having trouble knowing it then. And so I don't know whether Philip ever knew, because once he got into that hospital bed and was comfortable for the first time in months, I think he was so finally surrendered that I don't think he understood at that point what was going on. He was conscious and he was clear, but it was very difficult for him to talk because he had an oxygen mask on and he was very weak. But I think, I know he was still telling me, you know, would you go to the store and get me some, go to the health food store and get me some mangosteen juice, because they say that'll make me stronger. I mean, remember we read about that, and try and get some other product that he knew he wasn't going to get in the hospital. And then he went, you know, they gave him that Ativan to relax, and he never really emerged from that except for a very fuzzy moment, for a little few moments, and then they gave him morphine. So in that, I mean, I never saw him open his eyes again.
Joan, what happened between the time Philip was healthy and the time you went to San Diego with him?
Well, I can't even know because I don't know when he was healthy. You know, I mean, now that I'm looking back at it. But if I say when he was up and walking, how about that?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what happened or why it happened, but we were here in Fort Collins, and it was December, but it was beautiful, and we went to the park to have lunch, and I was listening, and he was listening to a story on our little MP3 players, and so I was kind of lost, and then I looked up, and he wasn't where I had left him. And I looked around, and he was kind of hanging on a tree. And I went over, and he said, I can't stand up, I can't breathe, I have so much pain. Kind of like right where we now think of, I'm pretty sure it was his gallbladder. And you know, the pain was so sharp that it was taking his breath away. And from that point, I mean, we just stood there and held him, and then we walked him home. And, you know, we were 2 weeks away from when we were, or not even, we were a week away from when we were booked to fly to Costa Rica. And I kept saying, are you sure we should do this? And his response to that was, if I want to live, I have to do that. I have to go because, for one thing, it might be my teeth, which was why we were going, and it might be that this is an infection that's gotten into my whole system, and I want to get that taken care of. And he was convinced that he couldn't eat well enough here, that he wasn't getting enough nutrition from the food that he was eating because he was only eating raw fruit, and it was winter. So I don't really know how I did it. I mean, I packed the entire apartment and moved stuff and, you know, like a small closet's worth of stuff to a friend's house, and the rest got dropped at ARC and every other thrift store in town. And a student helped me move a few things over, and then we got him onto the airplane we used a wheelchair. And even doing that, you know, the man who was wheeling the wheelchair turned to me and he said, is this your father? And Philip looked up at me, and we were both so shocked because, I mean, until this last year or so, people always guessed him to be younger than his age. And we were still seeing him that way. You know, I mean, he'd lost a tremendous amount of weight. And then between the time, I mean, he wasn't ever going to weigh himself. That was not in his world. But we went to a chiropractor because it was within walking distance. And I said, let's just see if somebody can identify what this place that's hurting is. And chiropractors know bodies, so maybe this will do it. And the chiropractor weighed him, and he weighed 104 pounds. And by the time we got to Costa Rica and gave up on the dentist because he was coughing so much that he couldn't stop coughing enough for a dentist to work on him, and he was so weak that the dentist simply said, I think you should go rest and take care of your body first, and I don't think it's an infection from what's going on in your mouth. And we went to this retreat center in the mountains that was also a fasting center, and crazy as that sounds, he couldn't hold any food. I mean, he could eat, but then he would have these incredible coughing things happen that exhausted him so badly that he didn't want to eat. So I called this man who understood the way that Philip had been choosing to eat, and who eats that way himself, and who runs the fasting center, and said, do you think that someone who's 5'11" and is now 104 pounds can fast, or can he just come there and do something else? And he said, he can fast. He said, I know it sounds crazy, I know it's amazing, but people can go so low down in weight before they're actually using their own muscles and their own reserves. And if he's having trouble eating anyway, then maybe this would give his body the time and the ease to heal itself, because 50% of your energy goes into digestion. So we went and we got there, and he got weighed, and this is 2 weeks later, he was 94 pounds. So I think even the man who runs this fasting center was a little bit shocked and said, okay, so we're not going to fast very long here, but just even a few days would be, I think, restorative. And Philip felt a whole lot better when he was fasting. The coughing stopped. Everything just kind of eased. But, of course, he was extremely weak. And we thought we'd be there for 2 weeks, and we ended up staying for 3 months because we couldn't figure out where else to take him or what to do. And the director of the center continued to believe that he would heal. I mean, he just kept saying it'll be a slow year, but he will heal. And it was only in about the last maybe month or even less of his life that Philip and I both sensed that the director of the center was not any more convinced. And we did go to a hospital in Costa Rica, finally, for some kind of diagnosis. Mostly because I think we were both afraid that, and I think the director was afraid that he would die there. And we didn't want to do that to this man who had been so kind to us. And he thought, still, he said, what if it is a lung infection and an antibiotic would heal it? I'm not a believer in conventional medicine, but if it were a choice between my life and an antibiotic, I would take an antibiotic. So we went, and it was a nightmarish day. It was just horrible. I mean, the hospitals were, first we went to a clinic, and then they took us to a hospital, and it was just, I mean, Philip ended up, by the end of the day, he was just totally hysterical almost, because I had to leave him to go and deal with the paying, and I was gone, and he's in this big open, it's not even a ward, like the emergency room there was nothing like anything I've seen here. And he was cold, and they didn't even give him a blanket, and it was just horrible. But the one thing that they were able to say and see was that they saw something in his lung. And they didn't know whether it was an infection or whether it was a tumor. And they wanted us to get back to the States as quickly as possible and find out. And that's where the plan to go to San Diego came in, because the doctor did say you should go back to a warm, dry climate. And so, March in Colorado is not warm, maybe dry, but it's not warm. And somehow or other we got this San Diego idea going and ended up there.
Joan, one of the things that's just been so powerful in my mind when I've heard your story is how you were by Philip's side and supporting him and his belief system, even when it might have conflicted with your own. How did you manage that?
Well, I was only partly convinced, or not even partly convinced. It was just a feeling of what if a more conventional approach to healing could help, and whether I would have done that. So it wasn't that hard for me to stand by him being more extreme or radical about his non-belief in conventional medicine. You know, when we were told that it might be a tumor and that it, he said, well, what am I going to do? He said, I'm not going to do chemotherapy or radiation treatment. That's out of the question. And that made me have to question, what would I do? You know, would I do that? And I don't think I would. So it wasn't that difficult. I think what was more difficult in some ways was to deal with my family and other people's responses. I mean, if people don't understand that perspective, they just think you're crazy. And they think you want to die or something, and they just can't sympathize, empathize, or anything like that.
So how would you respond to those kinds of remarks?
I had been responding to those kinds of remarks since about 1980, when Philip started getting sick, or 80, maybe 85 was when he started having strange things happening. And my response was always, what do you want me to do? Take a grown-up man, put him in a bag, and drop him off at a doctor's office? I mean, it just wasn't a choice. It was just a matter of respecting what he believed in and the way that he wanted to live his life, and admiring his courage to do that.
Seemed to be a theme for him.
Right, right.
What are the biggest challenges to adjusting to life without Philip?
I don't know, if everything that you kind of find a meaning in, comes in loving somebody, and then they're gone. It just doesn't, I don't know, it's just like, what's the point? You know? It all just suddenly gets very empty. And the realization that, you know, he's never going to be here. He's never going to hold me. He's never going to kiss me. We're never going to be lovers. It's just, it's like, then why? You know, I mean, I know that there are plenty of people in my life who care about me and people who I care about and people who I love. But it's not him. I don't know where you go from there.
What gifts? What gifts in your life came from your relationship with Philip?
So many things. I think because he questioned everything, he taught me to do that. He taught me to think beyond what I had been thinking. I thought when I met him, I still remember, I thought I was a open-minded, well-educated, progressive thinking person, and he challenged everything. At so many levels, while we were in our very first months together, I kept feeling like this strange physical sensation, like the bottom of my stomach was dropping out or something. It was like everything that I had put together was not being knocked down, but just being questioned and starting to be rearranged or something. And with that came an interest in travel that I hadn't really had, except, you know, I'd traveled in this country, but I'd never been out of this country, and he got us all over Europe and a year in England. He got me to go. Everything was always I was going to do it. You know, I went back to school so that we could go and live in England. And I mean, I was the one who would do the thing in the world. But that, I mean, think of that. I mean, we got involved in all kinds of things that I kind of acted out, including teaching English as a second language. Because in his mind, it was a way for us to either travel or get out of this country or discover some new way of coming to something. His love of beauty, his aesthetic sense was so defined and important to him, and that helped me in my life. So, you know, those carpets are from the Middle East, and you know, I mean, there's so many things that now when I look at life, when I think about even making this tiny little nest into a home, I know that it, I mean, there's nothing in here that he wouldn't like except this pillow that's down here because it's the wrong color. And the only reason it's here is because I didn't realize that it was the wrong color when I got it until I got it home in the light. So,
you and Philip have an extraordinary love. And it's such a privilege to share that with you. Thank you for letting me in.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you for doing this with me, mm-hmm. and really with me. Mm-hmm.